Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California with John Kam, who's going to speak on U.S.-China relations, what role for human rights. John Kam is the founder and executive director of the Doi Hua Foundation. My name is Cynthia Miyashita. I'm a volunteer at the club. I serve as the club's chair for its Asia-Pacific Affairs programs. I'd like to welcome you all and a particular welcome to any new members. We hope to see you here often. If you're not a member, we'd like to invite you to join. There is some information on the front table there and I think even a sign-up form. I would like to tell you about a couple programs we have coming up. This first one is sold out, but I'm just telling you about it to show you the diversity of programs that we do here. February 17th, we're going to have a tasting of Australian wines. I know, if you didn't sign up, you can still sign up. We have a waiting list. But we're going to start out with a tasting of Tasmanian sparkling wine, which I think sounds so exotic. And if you don't want to miss out in the future, you can add your name to my mailing list out here, and I'll send you updates and early announcements of programs we have coming up. March 8th, Andrew Lamb, who is the writer and co-founder of New America Media, has written a new book called East Eats West. Andrew Lamb, who emigrated from Vietnam as a child, looks at how the East and West are changing each other, from cuisine and martial arts to sex and self-esteem, from Buddhism to anime. Lamb will discuss and explore the marvelous world where two hemispheres meld into one. Praised for his wit and style, he will share his insights into the cultural consequences of immigration from Asia to the West. So I hope you'll join us for that program March 8th. And please go online at commonwealthclub.org for latest programs. At this time, I'm going to ask you to turn off your phones because we do record our programs for our archives as well as for possible radio broadcast. This time, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, John Kam. I'd like to start with the lead paragraph from a New York Times Magazine article who introduced John as follows. Almost no one seemed less likely to become a crusader for human rights than John Kam. He was a president of Hong Kong's American Chamber of Commerce and a regional vice president of Occidental Chemical Corporation, a multinational company that, in addition to paying Kam very handsomely, provided him with a luxury apartment, a Mercedes and driver, two maids, a cost of living allowance, private school tuition for his sons, and paid home leave. But he left this all behind in 1999 to start the Doi Hua Foundation, and I'm going to spell that for our radio audience, D-U-I-H-U-A, whose mission it is to improve human rights in China and the United States through a dialogue based on equality and mutual respect. Since that time, Doi Hua has earned an international reputation for its advocacy for political and religious prisoners in China and promotion of rule of law worldwide. The foundation was granted special consultative status by the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations in 2005. John pioneered a tool in human rights diplomacy, lists of prisoner names submitted to Chinese officials as a way to inquire about individual cases. Prisoner lists have since been used by several countries and organizations that raise prisoner cases with China as part of their own human rights dialogue. Kam estimates that his involvement has been at least partly responsible for about 250 prisoners being released or being given better treatment in prison. In the words of the New York Times, no other person or organization in the world, including the State Department, has helped more Chinese prisoners. Would you please join me in welcoming John Kam?
Thank you very much, Cynthia, for that very generous introduction. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to speak before the club on several occasions. It's always an event that I look forward to. And I'm especially grateful to Cynthia and to Lillian for the work that they do for the club in bringing speakers to address topics that have to do with Asia. And as I'm sure you know, and you don't need polls to tell you this, but lots of recent polls suggest that American attention is, in fact, shifting towards Asia increasingly. And in fact, a poll was just published today by Gallup in which Americans are asked which country is of greatest concern to the United States. And China comes out number one for the first time. 70% of Americans name China as a country of concern, great concern, vitally important or important, 70%. So today what I'd like to do is to address a number of topics and leave time for questions and answers. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about President Hu Jintao's visit to the United States, which took place on January 19th and 20th in Washington, and then, as you may know, he went to Chicago. And so I'll say a few words about that, and then I will get into a discussion of the current situation in China with respect to human rights and the impact that the recent midterm elections might well have, both on the overall relationship and on the role that human rights plays in that relationship. And then I'd like to end by talking to you a little bit about some of the initiatives that my foundation is involved with, because one of the things I've been trying to do in the last two or three years is to, while maintaining a focus, certainly, on the importance of detainee cases, but to move into new areas where I hope that the U.S. and China can find some common ground to discuss human rights in more of a cooperative spirit. And I'll probably are aware, if you follow our work, that juvenile justice is exactly one of those areas. But I also want to say a few words about women in prison, which is a burning issue, which, believe it or not, there has been practically no attention paid to this issue by any country in the world. And it's a very timely subject, so I'd like to end by saying a few words about that. Well, as you no doubt know, again, President Hu Jintao of China visited the United States, a state visit, January 19th through the 21st or 22nd. Now, this was President Hu's first state visit, if you consider from the American perspective. China thinks it's his second state visit. I think that gives you already some idea of the gulf between the two countries. They can't even agree whether it was the first or the second state visit. You may recall that in April of 2006, President Hu did visit the United States, but President George W. Bush refused to call it a state visit, instead insisting on calling it an official visit. That's right. Now, I suppose to many, especially those of us living in the United States or in the West, if you're invited to somebody's house and instead of it's a state visit or an official visit, yeah, no big deal. But as I'm sure you appreciate, for the Chinese, it is a big deal. And what's the difference? Well, I can tell you the difference exactly. The flags of the two countries, if it's a state visit, are hung on Pennsylvania Avenue, draped, I should say. If it's an official visit, that's not the case. In an official visit, you get 19-gun salute. And in a state visit, you get 21-gun salute. And finally, with the state visit, you get a state dinner. And with the other kind of visit, the official one, you get an official lunch. So that's the difference. So this was to be, in fact, President Hu Jintao's first visit. But, you know, It almost didn't take place. The reason I say that is that in the interval between President Obama's state visit in November of 2009 to President Hu's visit, and by the way, in 2009, the joint statement says that President Hu accepts the invitation to visit next year. So already you can see that it did not take place in the next year. It was actually in 2011. So, but in that interval between those state visits, you had a serious deterioration in the relationship. To the point that, and I've been involved with China for almost 40 years, not counting the latter years of the Cultural Revolution, I would say that the relationship between the United States and China in 2010 was as bad as it has been since Tiananmen in 1989-1990. There were disputes across a wide range of issues, but in addition to that, you had on both sides a very deep mistrust of the other. And I want to illustrate that by giving you an example, two examples, one from, if you will, the Chinese versus U.S. side, and the other from the Chinese versus U.S. side. Now, a month ago, I was in Beijing at the start of one of my round-the-world trips. So these examples, in other words, a week before President Hu went to the States, I was over there speaking with the people I usually speak with. So when I arrived, the day after, the morning after, I had breakfast with a senior advisor to the leadership. And the very first thing this friend of mine said to me is that there is a document circulating among cadres of a certain level and above, written by Ministry of State Security, which claims that there is clear evidence that President Obama and Secretary Clinton pressured the Norwegian Nobel Committee to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Liu Xiaobo. Now, that wasn't the first time I had heard that. And in fact, Chinese officials in their interactions with American officials have said this. I spoke to a senior diplomat in New York in November, and he said 100% of Chinese officials believe that that the United States orchestrated the Nobel Peace Prize. All right? Well, I have some knowledge of this subject. I have interacted with the Nobel Institute extensively for the last few years, and that simply is not the case. The United States government does not take a position on potential candidates, and there are good reasons for that. I mean, once you start, where does it end? You know, why would you support so-and-so but not so-and-so? I mean, you get into some very sticky situations. But more important than that, and I can say this perhaps with a bit of a chuckle, but if you really wanted to do in someone's chances to get the prize, you'd have the United States put pressure on the committee. That would be the kiss of death, no question about it. So I actually worked hard to dispel this impression. But was I successful? I don't know. But that's one example. In other words, here the Chinese believe something. The United States denies it. The Chinese still believe it. That's how deep the mistrust. Now, on the other side, where it's a U.S. Perception, we have this extraordinary episode of the testing of the stealth fighter. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but China has actually developed, years ahead of what our intelligence services have predicted, they've developed a stealth fighter. And they tested it on the very day that Secretary Gates was in Beijing meeting with President Hu Jintao. And Mr. Gates raised this with Hu Jintao. And Hu Jintao sort of looked around the room and he said, "What? We did?" He appeared to be taken by surprise. And that became the, if you will, party line. In all discussions with Americans, this was not timed to coincide with your visit, a sheer coincidence. Again, the United States side doesn't believe that. So you have that situation where on important issues, the two countries don't believe what the other one is saying. That is not a good situation. And if nothing else, this particular visit by Hu Jintao has gone a great deal in the direction of reducing that mistrust. Now, I don't think that, President Hu and President Obama have become the best friends in the world, but the relationship has improved. The mistrust has been lessened, and that's a tremendous achievement. Not much else, I'm afraid, was achieved by the visit. There was a regurgitation of existing positions on both, if the Obama visit in November of 2009 resulted in a 13-page single-space joint statement. And what this joint statement essentially did was to say, we reiterate, we reinforce, we reassert, we confirm, etc. There really was only one significant, I think, change that came out of this visit, and that, of course, has to do with North Korea. And if you look at the statement, China takes a harder line with respect to the North, expresses concern over their development of a plutonium processing facility. And you may know that after this visit, in fact, the two Koreas did have talks, which have collapsed, which is another lesson to always bear in mind that I've known for years and years. This idea that that China can tell North Korea what to do is simply not the case and hasn't been for a long, long time. But in any event, that came out of it. Now, on our topic, on human rights, you had a couple of paragraphs. Essentially, what the statement says is that the two countries have confirmed that we will have another round of the human rights dialogue that will take place before the first round of the strategic and economic dialogue. So that should probably take place in May. But that's really not a new development. The dialogue was resumed last May, and it was stated at the time that the dialogue would, in fact, take place in a year. And then they have also announced that the so-called legal experts dialogue will be resumed. That, however, is the third time in 18 months that the two countries have announced that the legal experts dialogue will be resumed. So this, again, this is not new. But I must say the one sentence in the joint statement that struck me is that the two countries agreed to discuss the important role of women in society. And that's in the joint statement. And that's very significant, and I'll return to this later, okay? So it didn't achieve much, except it achieved a lot. And that is it reduced mistrust, improved communication, and hopefully we can build on that. Now, I've been toying with changing the topic of my remarks from this point on to immovable object meets irresistible force. Because what we have brewing, I'm afraid, is a potentially serious situation in the relationship, which will see some quite heated rhetoric and quite possibly a deterioration again. And in this area, of course, human rights is going to be a major situation. Let's start with the situation in China. Now, China is in the midst of a major leadership transition. It happens every 10 years. The chairman of the Communist Party steps down, and a new chairman comes in. That's going to happen in about 18 months. So it's an often, I think, too often used term, but Hu Jintao is in effect, a lame duck. And there's tremendous jockeying going on within the government for seats on the top ruling body, which is the Standing Committee of the Politburo. Okay, and we have some guesses as to who's going to wind up. We certainly are, I think most people are convinced that the new chairman will be Mr. Xi Jinping, and the new prime minister will be Li Keqiang, although that's not as certain. And we have other players who are jockeying to get in. But suffice to say, in this kind of an atmosphere, just as it is here in the United States, in, when people are running or jockeying for political position, being soft on anything that is perceived as contributing to instability or the possible, if you will, diminution of the ruling power of the Communist Party, this, if you're running for leadership in the Communist Party, you're going to oppose, and you're going to oppose very strongly. So set that against what's been going on for the last 5 years. In 2005, China began what is called the campaign against the color revolutions. You may recall that there were a series of revolutions in former Soviet states and other countries. Lebanon comes to mind, Georgia, and so on and so forth. And they all had a color name to them, a pink revolution, a purple revolution. Well, Mr. Putin, who at the time was president of Russia, visited China in the spring of 2005 and said to Mr. Hu Jintao, "Watch out. You're next. The U.S. and its allies are aiming to get you." And for various reasons, Mr. Hu and the other leaders sort of took this on board. So we immediately started to see a change in China's attitude and stance towards such things as dissent. And, you know, we have seen a very substantial increase in the number of people who have been arrested and tried for endangering state security. In fact, this is one of the things that China actually does produce statistics on. And so we can tell you that the number of people who are who have been arrested and tried for this most important political crime has doubled in 3 years. So that's, you know, they've really started in 2005 to crack down on dissent. Now, in addition to that, 2005 and moving forward, China has, the central government, the leadership, the Communist Party leadership, has suffered three big shocks in the last 3 years. Shocks that have really shaken them to the core. And in any kind of a situation, when that happens, they're going to get more defensive. I'm not making excuses here. I'm just trying to speak realistically. I do a lot of work in this area. The first shock, of course, was March 2008, the uprising in Lhasa and the Tibetan Plateau. The second was July of 2009, the riots in Urumqi. And this year, a few months ago, of course, the selection of Liu Xiaobo as the first Han Chinese Nobel laureate. And remember, the prize goes back to 1905. So that's quite astonishing. So these three things have happened, and once again, it's encouraged this mindset of we're under siege, you know, and sometimes bordering, I'm sorry to say, on the paranoia. The situation right now that affects our work perhaps the most, you know, as Cynthia said, we concentrate on trying to get early release, better treatment for prisoners. They've essentially stopped releasing people early. And so in addition to having an increase in the number of people going in, you have a decrease in the number of people who are going out early. And the result of all this is that you have a population of people in prison for political crimes, certainly at the highest level since Tiananmen. Actually, I think it's higher. So we have the situation I've just outlined in China. I would say that that aptly describes an immovable object. They are not going to, and I haven't even mentioned Egypt, but maybe we'll get into that in the Q&A. And obviously, they see something like Egypt take place, and they get worried about that. We can argue whether they should or not, but they do. That's why they've, you know, taken, you can't do a search for Egypt anymore in China, you know. They've taken it out, and they're, you know, they're censoring Egypt, believe it or not. And even where, of course, they know that Chinese are going to find out about what's going on, they've developed a line about it, which is that this shows the failure of democracy. That, in effect, Egypt has been a sort of a chaotic democratic state, and so, beware of democracy. Gives you some idea of the immovable nature of the situation there. Now, so we have this immovable object, but what about in this country? Well, I've been sort of interested in looking at the impact of the last election, potential impact on U.S.-China relations. How many of you noticed during the last election that there were a lot of campaign advertisements that mentioned China? Lots. In this state, I must have seen Barbara Boxer's ad against Ms. Fiorina for shipping jobs to China, I don't know, several dozen times. It was running all the time. And it was an effective ad. It definitely hurt her opponent. But that's only one of as many as 40 different congressional races in which China figured in attack ads against the opponent, and it came from both sides of the aisle. It wasn't just Democrats against Republicans. Republicans went after Democrats. So for the first time, China emerged as a major issue in an American election. Major issue. I mean, there's always been a little bit, butchers of Beijing and what have you after Tiananmen. But this was an issue that was used against opponents. I don't think there were any ads after Tiananmen that said, so-and-so supported what happened in Tiananmen Square. But now you have candidates who are trying to tag their opponents with pro-China positions. Now, we now have a situation that the new GOP leadership in the House of Representatives is made up of, especially on the foreign affairs side, of the most critical members of Congress on China in at least two decades. And I don't think enough people have really paid attention to this. The new chairwoman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee is a lady by the name of Ileana Ross Leightonen, congresswoman from Florida, South Florida, who is the daughter of Cuban refugees. She hates communism, and I'm sure she would not disagree with me one bit. And she has an especial dislike for China. And it's focused very much on human rights. She's been very, very critical of the human rights record. And among other things, she is a frequent speaker at the Falun Gong rallies, as well as taking some other positions. Her subcommittee chairman, Ed Royce, from Southern California, Dana Rohrabacher, Dan Burton, all of these men have distinguished themselves in the past as being critics of China. They all voted against China's most favored nation. And in fact, Congresswoman Ross Leightonen has introduced legislation to take MFN away from China, which won't happen. But I that old saying, nothing is ever settled in Washington? Well, so we have a situation now where we had an election in which China was an issue and was played successfully by several candidates. We have a situation where the House is now dominated by Republicans who have very pronounced opinions on China, very critical, and the perfect storm, the minority leader, Nancy Pelosi. Now, Nancy Pelosi, when she was Speaker, as third in line to the presidency, had no choice but to restrain herself. She went to Beijing and hardly mentioned human rights. I mean, she did privately, but certainly nothing along at the level that she used to. Well, I think that now that she is, in effect, freed from that leadership position, she will seek to reclaim the mantle of leadership on human rights in China. So it is not surprising to me that she led the U.S. delegation to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony and very proud of it, said it's the most important trip she's made in years, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a situation where an irresistible force is building, and it's going to be targeting China. Now, the other thing to look at, as I mentioned briefly in my opening remarks, are the polls. And there's a lot coming out now. A lot of polls are being taken on China. And this is, again, quite interesting. On the one hand, Americans recognize that China is of vital importance to this country. And there's a strong feeling that we should work as a country to improve relations. Yet, at the same time, you get a great deal of disquiet, misgivings, over China's policies in the area of trade, human rights, and security. So in a Pew poll, which says, you know, a majority of Americans think we should improve relations with, you know, China, the same poll says, but a majority say we got to do more to promote human rights, we got to do more to promote environmental policies, we've got to get tougher on China and trade and economics. So you've got this kind of split view. On the one hand, Americans recognize the importance. On the other hand, they say we got to get tougher. Now, since, you know, at this forum in the past, I have pointed this out. In the months prior to Tiananmen in 1989, China had a 75% to 80% approval rating, according to the Gallup poll, which is the gold standard friends and enemies poll. It should be coming out any day for 2011. So you had a China favorable rating of around 80, you know. We used to call them the cuddly communists. This was back when, you know, Russia was decidedly not a cuddly communist. After Tiananmen, it went down to 32, which is, I think, almost a record for the collapse of public opinion towards another country. It is now around 42, and it has stayed in this low 40s range for many, many years. So, again, we go back to this. You've got a situation where Americans see it as a very important relationship, concerned about China. They're afraid of China in many respects. They see China as a threat. They see China, actually, if you ask Americans, they'll tell you China has a bigger economy than the United States. More Americans think China has a bigger economy than the United States than Americans who think that the U.S. still has the biggest. And it isn't close. Ladies and gentlemen, it is not close. And on a per capita basis, it's laughable. But that's the perception. People are afraid. So the polls suggest that if you're going to run and China's going to be an issue, you're going to be hard on China. Now, so we go from there. Let's see what happened, just as an illustration of what happened when Hu Jintao went to Washington. Well, as you know, on the 19th, he had the discussions with Mr. Obama. On the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, at the very moment that their talks began, Congresswoman, Chairman Ileana Ross Layton convened only her second full committee hearing as chairwoman, and it was on China. Second one. First one was on Sudan, on the referendum. Second one on China. And she had some of the top critics of China as witnesses, and she herself made statements, as did other members of the committee. Hard statements, very hard statements. I actually, if you're interested, I can read a little excerpt from what she had to say. Let's see now. She said that the United States took a big gamble when it voted for permanent normal trade relations for China over a decade ago, in what some term the most important vote since World War II. That vote was based upon what I see as a sadly mistaken belief that economic openness and free market reforms would lead to democracy, respect for rule of law, and a full array of political and human rights for the Chinese people. Well, you know, she is not alone in that view. A lot of members happen to think that. And when you look across to these other committees, you get Ways and Means. The chairman of Ways and Means comes from Michigan. Now, Michigan is a state that's been very, very hard hit by the recession. And Mr. Camp had this to say: China is not acting in good faith, and is aggressively engaged in a series of troubling and downright protectionist policies that put our relationship at risk. And that's Ways and Means. And then you got the gentleman that's running the Armed Services Committee, who pronounced a few days ago that China is a threat on the same level as terrorism in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I'm just, making the point that we have a very different situation going on in Congress, and the political atmosphere in this country, I think, favors increasing attacks on China by people seeking office in 2012. But, you know, the final, and in a sense this is good news, the final, sign that China could very well be an important issue in next year's election is the apparent decision by Ambassador John Huntsman to come back and run for president. He's been our ambassador in China. Now, I think that's a very smart move. On the one hand, of course, he's going to be under attack by other Republicans in the primary. On the other hand, if China is really an important issue, I don't think anyone comes close to his experience and knowledge of China. He speaks the language. He's been there. So if it's a debate about China, I'm John Huntsman, and I say, well, you know, have you ever been there? You know, do you know any of the leaders? You know what I'm saying? And by the way, I want to say, on human rights, he's been very, very good. Really, I'm very proud of him as our ambassador. I can talk more about that, but, we have a very serious case in China involving an American citizen who's one of only two Americans who's been convicted of endangering state security, and he's been sentenced to 8 years. His appeal is being heard. But John Huntsman has visited him 6 times in the detention center, which is unheard of for an American ambassador. Unheard of. But he's been 6 times, and when he couldn't do it, he sent his number two guy. So he showed a lot of concern for this man, who, I must say, has been subjected to some very bad treatment and certainly violation of due process rights, not to mention the U.S.-China consular agreement, which, for those of you who ever get in trouble in China, you better know that by treaty, China must grant access to you within 4 days. All right? Must, by treaty. In Mr. Xuefeng's case, it was 4 weeks. And he was not treated very well during that period. Okay, so I want to sort of get into the last part here because I want to end up here certainly no later than 10 minutes from now. You know, I just mentioned the hearing, but something else extraordinary happened on January 19th, and that is the entire congressional leadership, with the exception of Nancy Pelosi, boycotted the state dinner. In my life, I cannot remember such a thing, but Mr. Boehner boycotted. Mitch McConnell didn't go. Harry Reid called him a dictator, Hu Jintao, which he apparently had to sort of back off. But Nancy Pelosi went, and those are your four top congressional leaders. Three of the four boycotted the state banquet. Again, I think this gives you some idea of the depth of feeling on Capitol Hill. This is unheard of. So the Hu visit, on the one hand, it was very warm and welcoming on one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, but on the other end, it wasn't. It was frosty, and it was a difficult trip. And with the scenario I've just laid out, where China has its own concerns, and I should add, China, frankly, does not have the same respect for international opinion that it did years ago. China, the leadership in China is much more interested in what Chinese people think about it and a lot less interested in what others think about it. And that's an important change. But in that kind of situation, the old appeal that I've used for years is, you know, China, you got to do this or that because it'll improve your image in the States. Even now, they'll admit that and say, thank you very much. You were right. It did. But, you know, those days are gone. We don't feel the need to have to do that anymore. And so you can see over the last year, to many, many people's astonishment, they took very, very hard stands, for instance, with Japan over the islands, with the South China Sea, you know, with Korea. So they're more assertive, and they're just not really going to listen to that old argument that you got to do this or that to, you know, to improve your image or appease international. They're really not interested. So we have to find, we have to find areas where, in fact, they are interested in the area of human rights. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to find those areas, and we've got to build trust, and we've got to make successes. And then when we've got that foundation, I'm not saying ignore. By the way, I've worked on plenty of cases of juveniles who were put in prison for their beliefs. I mean, probably one of my top five cases is the Awang Sandral case. A Tibetan nun, singing Nuns of Drapchi. She was 13 years old when she was detained, 15 years old when she was sentenced. So it's not as though by working on juvenile justice you're turning your back on these other issues. But I have to tell you, this effort, and we got Sonia Ng in the audience. She was with us as our expert, I should say interpreter, beyond that, sort of driving force at many points. I mean, this woman has incredible energy. But we, Dui Hua, in conjunction with a foundation in Hong Kong and the MacArthur Foundation, we brought to the United States first a group of Chinese judges to look at the American juvenile justice system with all its flaws. China is trying to set up its own system. It for many years, didn't need a system. I mean, you didn't have the kind of juvenile crime that you have in China today. Juvenile crime in China is doubling every 5 years. It's a very serious, very serious problem. And the government, to its credit, has decided we're going to try to do something about this. Like what? Pass a criminal procedure law for juveniles, right? Set up juvenile courts instead of having sort of tribunals under adult courts. So they've made these decisions. But where to begin? How do you learn about this stuff? So one of the things we did was take them to the states. They went around the states. And at the end of it, they returned to China and wrote up a report that was very well received. And then we were invited. And so we just sent a delegation over there. Now, having worked in the area of political crime for many years, I can tell you there's not a whole lot I can point to in terms of systemic change. But when working in juvenile justice, I have just been amazed at how much positive impact we have had. Now, I don't know how many of you know about our own system of juvenile justice, but, you know, we in this country, if you're a juvenile and you're arrested by the police, there's about a 1 in 10 chance that you'll actually wind up in prison. Okay? And the reason for that is we practice something called diversion. And I think you can figure out what I'm talking about. Basically, the kid is brought in with the family. You sit there with the prosecutor, the DA. Here's a juvenile DA. And you say, okay, young man or young woman, this is what you're going to do. You know, you're going to make restitution. You're going to stay away from these people. You're going to be home by 6. You're going to do your homework. And you do an agreement. And after 6 months, if you have fulfilled the agreement, okay, case dropped. And if after another year you stay out of trouble, your record is what we call sealed, which is really expunged. In China, they are doing these things now, just in the last year or so. They call it deferred prosecution instead of diversion, and they have sealing of records. And you could directly point to these delegations as having helped bring this about. So that's the kind of thing I think we should be doing. And I have to tell you, I just came from Beijing. I'm doing that with the Supreme Court, but at the same time, I'm still able to talk about prisoners with other ministries. And it helps. It really does. If they see you doing this other work, and then you say, but, you know, I'm still very interested in these cases. That's one thing. But I want to wind up with women in prison, because that's another area. I wonder how many of you know that in December of last year, the United Nations General Assembly passed the standard rules for the treatment of women in prison and non-custodial measures for women offenders in December of last year. This is an effort that was started by a princess of Thailand who was trained as a lawyer at Columbia Law School and had gone back to Thailand to be a prosecutor. And the story goes, she visited a women's prison, and as she was going through the prison, a female prisoner came forward and prostrated herself before the princess. And in that moment, she decided, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to devise rules to improve the treatment of women in prison. Now, what I want to do, and I've invited the Chinese to send a delegation to this country to look at how we handle women in prison. Not because I think we handle women in prison well. In fact, it's a disgrace. I mean, Americans should be ashamed of the way women are treated in the prisons of this country. Did you know that in some states women are shackled when they give birth in the prison? In the state of California, 48 hours is what the mother gets with the child. The child is taken away after 48 hours. You know, I was in Geneva talking to a real expert, an English jurist in this area, and he said, you know, I hope you know what you're doing, because once you start taking a look at how women are treated in American prisons, you might think twice about inviting the Chinese. But that's the whole point. That's the whole point. You want the Chinese to come over, and you want to be seen to be showing them warts and all the problems we have in this country with juveniles. You know, I remember, I just as an aside here, when we took the Chinese to a facility in Maryland, it was a model prison for juveniles, 40 juveniles, they had a wonderful football field, library. At the end of it, the Chinese delegation leader, this is the third detention center we'd been in, and he said, when are you going to show us the detention center for white people? You know, these are eye-opening remarks that you can only, as an American, when you see your own country through the eyes of others. You know, you can talk about racial discrimination in the system, but it takes something like that for you to say, that's right. We've been in three prisons, and not a single white face have we seen. So I'm going to end there because I want to leave some time for questions and answers, and some people might have to leave a little early. I think we've got a very interesting period ahead in the relationship. As part of that irresistible force meeting the immovable object, human rights will once again become a very, very important issue in the relationship. We at the Dui Hua Foundation are committed to doing everything we can to advance human rights in both countries through non-confrontational means. We avoid naming and shaming. We take the other route. I'm not condemning naming and shaming. We could not do what we do if we didn't have NGOs that took harder positions. I mean, we're the classic good cop versus the bad cops. And I'm very proud of that. And whenever anybody says to me, oh, you do things differently than Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, I say, yeah, but we couldn't do it without them. The only reason we can do it is because of their courage and their advocacy and their hard work exposing the abuses. Then we kind of go in and say, okay, here's what you might want to do about it, you know. So with that, thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
John, thank you so much. We do have a microphone here because we are recording this program. So if you have a question, Lillian will bring the mic to you.
Hi, I have a question. Thank you. You mentioned a lot on what Americans think of China. I'd like to hear more on what how Chinese people think. I would imagine that their understanding of human rights is a little different from the way the typical American thinks of that concept even. What's your sense on what the majority of people in China think of their government's suppression of dissent, and you know, what do everyday people in China think the role of human rights is in the development of their country?
That's an excellent question, and I guess I could start by saying I'm not too sure of what the answer is, and there are reasons for that. First of all, polling in China is truly in its infancy, and it is no question but that there are constraints. Even when people are asked questions and given assurances that it's totally anonymous. There's still, I think, a feeling that, hey, I got to be a little bit careful of what I say. That's one thing. Secondly, as you point out, there are different perceptions of human rights. We in this country tend to put more emphasis on civil and political rights, whereas in China the emphasis has been on, understandably, economic, social, and cultural rights. By the way, these are the two great areas of human rights. There are covenants for both that are, of course, international documents. And interestingly, the United States has ratified the civil and political rights, but not the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Convention. And China has ratified the social, economic, and cultural, but not ratified the political. So right away you see there's a bit of a divide on what rights should be more emphasized. And, of course, then you have tremendous regional variations. I dare say if you took a poll in Xinjiang or Tibet about, you know, the views of local people about policies of the Chinese government, you get a very different view than if you took the same poll in Shanghai or in Guangzhou. Now, to the extent that there are, however, some good polls, they don't really focus so much on human rights, but they do look at this question of, you know, how important is America to China? And there's no question there. Where we have just now entered this period where China is seen as the most important relationship, which itself is quite astonishing in my lifetime to see that, you know. In China, the U.S. has been, if you go to a, and I do, I speak it to audiences in China, campuses, et cetera, and you ask, what is the most important relationship for China? You'll get, I'm telling you, 80 to 90% will say the United States. There's no question about it. So that's been the case for a long time, and it's only becoming the case now. But you do have, you know, there you have to be careful of polls. I mean, there was a poll that was put out by a Chinese university and Duke University. And frankly, Duke is not known for its polling. And so, you know, but you look at Pew and you look at Gallup and some of the other polling organizations. They've been doing this for years. It's consistent year by year. You have good sampling techniques. You know, there's a lot of work that's gone into this. In China, it's very much in the infancy. But I point that out because, you know, there was just a poll published after the WHO visit that, you know, everything's just hunky-dory. I mean, basically, you know, the relationship is great. You know, we're friends again, da-di-da-di-da. I think that's an overstatement. That's a long answer to a very good question. Thank you. Shall I just, yeah.
This is somewhat tangential, but the human rights abuses in China pales to that of North Korea. I know that's not your topic, but I appreciate you commenting on that. And then I think something we're all curious about is somehow getting, and I don't know if you can explain it, but commenting on the psyche of North Korea and their leaders.
Boy, I wish, you know, I'm sorry to say I haven't done more work in North Korea, but I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, China is a paradise compared to what we know goes on in North Korea. And what to do about it? You know, a very good friend of mine is our North Korea official in charge, and I see he's been having talks with the North Koreans. It's just a desperate, desperate situation there. And you may know that they're facing another big food crisis. They have been aggressively soliciting food donations and aid from other countries. So it's not looking good. You know, they've withdrawn from the international covenants, just as they have the nuclear treaties. There is no dialogue on human rights with North Korea. I understand that it has been brought up by various countries, and the response is, you know, our human rights situation is great. You know, it's 100% perfect. Everybody loves the leadership, and there are no problems, none. I don't see much chance for dialogue. On the other hand, it's such a, you know, opaque society, and we don't really know what's going on. Who knows? It could change at the top. I mean, they'd be very, very smart to do so, I think. but there are no signs that that's going to happen. Right now, the emphasis remains on the military side of things. And even there, as I said, this most recent, these talks that were hopefully going to lead to better relations collapsed again yesterday. The North Koreans walked out. So it's not looking too good.
First of all, John, thank you very much for your comments. Very knowledgeable and to the point, as usual. I wonder, though, given where China is in its leadership cycle and where we are in terms of elections and the situation you described in terms of distrust, can anything be done? Do you have any ideas for what could be done to improve relations between the two countries?
Well, I tried to indicate actually my own thinking on this. I think we really have to show where dialogue works. I think Americans heard it enough. You know, the Chinese position has always been, let's have a dialogue. But if the dialogue doesn't really produce change of a positive nature, then sooner or later people are going to say, what's the point? And I'm afraid that that is a very strong view, not only in the U.S., but in European countries as well. They say, hey, we've been having these dialogues for years and years, and nothing seems to have changed. So what I think we need to do is, while maintaining that conversation about things we disagree with each other on, we've got to find these areas where we agree. And human rights is a very big field. And who's to say that the rights of the child and the rights of women are somehow less important than the rights of political prisoners? Who's to say that? I mean, they should be equally important, I think. There's a lot of overlap, by the way, as I've tried to point out. So I think we need to do more of that, so that when in a debate with someone, you can say, but look what we did with juvenile justice. Before we started this, 80% of Chinese youth were wound up in prison after arrest. Now it's 40 or 50%. There's another great example of how, in fact, international dialogue has led to a very positive, or contributed to, a positive development in China. And I hesitate always to bring this up with an American audience, but it's the death penalty. 10 years ago, China was executing more than 10,000 people a year. Now it's around 5,000. Now, there you go. But that's China. You see, that's the whole point. You got to really think about this for a minute. Okay, here's the good news. The good news is they've cut the number of people who they execute in half. The bad news is they still execute 5,000 people. But the fact is that they have sharply reduced and they have increased due process rights for people on death row. They have a long way to go. It's a very, like in this country, there's widespread support for capital punishment. And, the U.S. and Chinese people have a lot of similarities in terms of their views on things. And I tell you, on capital punishment, it's almost exactly the same. It's like 70% in both countries. Now, to give you some idea of how difficult this issue is in China and to make progress in China on this, and I have to point out, I mean, if you look at the literature in China, one of the reasons they have embarked upon this is because of these international exchanges, especially with Europe. It's the number one issue for Europe in human rights dialogues is capital punishment, even with us. Okay. Well, in China, you see my newsletter. Hopefully you'll take it away and read it. But a couple of months ago, there was a report that China was going to reduce by 13 the number of crimes that attract the death penalty. And, you'll see that we say, well, that's symbolic. It's important, but it's symbolic because there have practically been no executions for these crimes in many years. So it really was an effort on the part of the leadership to move China in the direction of, lessening executions by doing it this way. All right. Well, as part of these proposals that went before the National People's Congress was the idea that you prohibit executions for people over the age of 75. Well, 2 weeks ago, at a meeting of the National People's Congress in China, a huge debate erupted over this.
There was a lot of opposition to it. One delegate said, you know, if we take this move, these criminal gangs are going to go out and hire all these 75-year-old men to commit all these murders. And, you know, you get, what was that old movie about all the old guys going around? But, you know, this is, so all discussion of that reform has been shelved. Just to give you some idea how difficult it is, even where it is clearly in China's interest, and the leadership knows this, you know, they put a lot of emphasis on harmonious society. Well, it's hard to have a harmonious society in a country with that kind of dense population where you execute 10,000 people a year. I mean, just think of it. I mean, that person knows lots of people, and it's a real irritant to social harmony. So we have to find areas where we can, in fact, identify areas where we can work together. We achieve some things. And then when we get into a debate about people who want to, of course, focus solely on all the things that are wrong, you can say, yes, but, you know, look at this, look at that. That's what I think we have to do. But I'm not naive. I think that voice is going to be mostly drowned out in the debates to come.
Hi. So I have two questions. How do you think the Western media portrays China, and do you think it's slanted? And one more question is, everything's happening at a great pace in China, like economic development. Do you think that they will put forth the same energy and investment into human rights as well? Will we see like a surge in that area?
Well, those are great questions. Well, first of all, look, whether it's China or San Francisco or just about any topic you want, I mean, the media is a very big thing, and different journalists take different views on China. There are some journalists who have been very critical of China over the years, and, you know, I think it's safe to say that there's some bias there. On the other hand, I know some journalists who are very pro-China. And so it's very hard to generalize. I think that's one of the great things about a free press. I mean, you don't, you know, if you identify a journalist as having bias one way or the other, you just, you know, you don't read them. It's like the news. I'm not going to mention any channels. If you don't like certain news channels, you don't watch it. I try to watch as many as I can just to get some idea of the nature of the debate. But, you know, that's yes, it's true. Some are biased, others aren't. On balance, you know, I think over the years it's been fair treatment on balance, but certainly there have been plenty of examples of biased treatment. I would say at this point that the Chinese government could certainly do itself a lot of favors by treating the press better. And that's, you know, if you want to get good coverage, It's important to treat the journalists as well as possible. Let me put it that way. And do I think that the Chinese people themselves will pay more attention to human rights as they become more prosperous? The answer is yes, absolutely. And we're seeing it. It may not, again, be the same kind of conversation that we might have with our own government, but, you know, they do, in fact, recognize the importance of listening to citizens' views and complaints. You may have seen a couple of weeks ago that the premier, Wang Jiabao, went to a petition office. First time that's ever happened. These are where people come to file petitions against government. He went there and, you know, encouraged people to do more of that. So it's going to take some time, but I think it's moving in the right direction. Tremendous odds are faced by very brave people. You know, I think tonight of this blind lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, who's just having a terrible time in Shandong. He's been released from prison since September, but he's effectively, you know, in prison. He's under strict house arrest. He smuggled out a videotape of his imprisonment that he filmed, and this is circulating now on the web. I commend it to you. There's a very troubling report that yesterday the police, now that it's known, the police went to his house and beat him up, and he and his wife. So these are the kind of tragedies we deal with every day, But you can't say that the police in Shandong represent the whole country any more than you can say that the police in New York City represent the whole country in terms of the police forces. There are systemic issues in both places. And in the area of torture, China needs a lot of work. Even though regulations are in place that prohibit the use of evidence obtained by torture or coercion, the problem is proving it. The benefit of the doubt goes with the police. And so that has to be worked on. Yes?
With regard to political prisoners, it's impossible to work upon a case unless one knows a name. Do you have any inkling of a percentage of names that we know as in relation to percentage that we don't know?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, you know what? What I think I'm proudest of, and I have some of my colleagues in the room, I mean, what Dui Hua has done that I don't think others have done is to exhaustively search for those names in what we call open sources. So at any time somewhere in the world, Dui Hua has people looking in provincial legal newspapers, in county public security gazettes, in court records, and so on and so forth. On the internet, there's a tremendous amount of information. So, but to answer your question, despite all that effort, we've uncovered the names of about 6,000 prisoners that were not known. Despite all that effort, I don't think we know even 10%. It's a huge challenge for our work, but I can say that when we started this, maybe we knew 5%. But that's all, 10%, if that. You know, as I say, they put out statistics. How many people are arrested every year for endangering state security? I think last year, what was it, 1,100 or so? We don't know 100. So it's something that that we need to spend more time and work on. And here, too, I mean, as China opens, hopefully, we will get more of the names. But as you say, you can't intervene on behalf of somebody if you don't know their names. So, sir.
You made a comment about how Egypt was blocked in China, but they would, you know, people would still find out, I guess. As information in China becomes less centralized and is more available to more people, I guess, what do you think the effect of that is going to be over time?
Well, it already you can see. I mean, they've got over 400 regular users of the internet, 400 million. Cell phone usage and all that has exploded. I think it's very, very difficult for any government to control all that. That said, they're making quite an effort. we do need to always bear in mind that, you know, this is a government and a people that are very gifted in terms of technology and the sciences, mathematics, and so on. And on top of that, they got a lot of money. And you put those two things together, and they're going to be able to do things that we wouldn't have thought possible when Bill Clinton years ago was asked, "Do you think China will be able to control the internet?" His response was, "Good luck." It hasn't been quite as, I think we need to be a little less sanguine. They're going to, you know, there's a great saying in Chinese, I'm sure you've heard it, to scare the monkey, you kill the chickens. Kill the chicken, scare the monkey. And in so many respects, they rely on that. I mean, you know, maybe they can't get everybody to stop talking about something or other. But if somebody puts a post on there that's especially worrisome to the government and that person goes to prison, that does have a chilling effect. So it's not just the technology, it's the system that retaliates and that people know about. But I do think, you know, we see it all the time. Things show up on the internet in China and last for a little while.
things you wouldn't imagine that they'd get away with. And they're also, of course, Chinese being a language where you can use homophones, is that the correct term? Words that sound the same. So, for instance, you know, Charter 08, which is the pro-democracy manifesto Liu Xiaobo helped author. Well, apparently the words in Chinese for Charter 08 or charter are the same as, a county magistrate or something like that. So, you know, you've got these conversations going on. Oh, what do you think about the county magistrate? Oh, pretty good, you know, this kind of thing. So what are you going to do in that situation? You've got a situation where the language is such that controlling it is often very difficult indeed. Yes, the lady back there.
Yeah, I want to offer something that a lot of Americans may not have access to, the kind of historical cultural insights you're offering, because the speed with which the history in China has progressed, there is a movie called The Emperor's Shadow that showed the situation when China was not unified and what the first emperor, Qin Shi Huang Di, did. Mm-hmm. You basically wage war to achieve peace. Okay, so in English, that's called the emperor's shadow. And to take China from that period to what's called modern Chinese history, we're about the same age, okay? So I put 40 years. In fact, I went into China through Hong Kong in 1971. Okay, so now, I think the official Chinese diplomatic language is the two, U.S. and China, are two great countries with different histories and different conditions. Okay, so there is, for English language audiences, television now on cable Comcast 175 called ICN, Information Culture News. And 174 is the Japanese channel, 173 is the Korean channel. And I think if Americans had access to that, like if they had access to Al Jazeera, they would get more different kinds of news. So one perspective I wanted to put out and ask if you've run across this in your talks with many of the congressional people is the military security stance that the U.S. is taking towards China, because the word was that 9/11, September 11th, happened because the entire intelligence community was focused on studying war with China based on the Taiwan Straits. And they were really into this in the mid-late 18, especially after Tiananmen. Okay, so based on that, they describe the West Pacific, the Western Pacific, as more important, just as or more important than the Middle East to the United States' future. And therefore, most Americans are not aware that our military is quite ramped up all throughout the Pacific, Hawaii, Okinawa, and moving Marines to Guam. And therefore, it harkens back to the Cuban Missile Crisis days. If there were 8,000 U.S. Marines on the U.S. Protectorate of Guam, Free Association, with the accompanying personnel and forces, about 40 or 50,000, in addition to the existing Anderson Air Force Base. So China is seeing the U.S. move its forward operating bases, as well as using, I guess there's been a space race going on for the last 2 years, too. But do you hear these things discussed when people talk about China being a threat?
Well, thank you. To be honest with you, I don't talk much to Congress about China's military and strategic objectives in large measure because I don't know very much about the subject. My area has been in human rights, and but you make some good